Dr. Brent James is Chief Quality Officer and Executive Director of the Institute for Healthcare Delivery Research at Intermountain Healthcare. He is a member of the prestigious National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine and participated in many of that organization's seminal studies on quality and patient safety. Dr. James graduated magna cum laude with Bachelor of Science degrees in Computer Science and Medical Biology from the University of Utah. He holds a master's degree in statistics and earned his MD also from the University of Utah, with residency training in general surgery and oncology. Dr. James is a fellow of the American College of Physician Executives and holds faculty appointments at the University of Utah School of Medicine, the Harvard School of Public Health, and the University of Sydney School of Public Health in Australia. Dr. James has been honored with a series of awards for his work in assessing quality in healthcare delivery. In 2011, he was the first healthcare professional to be awarded the Columbia University School of Business's Deming Cup, a distinction recognizing world leaders who have made outstanding contributions in fostering operational excellence and continuous improvement in their organization. Just 2 weeks ago, Dr. James was awarded the Packard Lectureship by the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, the nation's only federal health sciences university. The Packard Lecture is the university's most prestigious lectureship. Dr. James is a member of a number of national task forces and committees that examine healthcare quality and cost control, including the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and his most recent appointment by the Federal Comptroller to an advisory group on making American healthcare more accessible and affordable. Dr. James and his wife Eve have a son who is an alumnus of BYU and two daughters still at home. Would you please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Brent James?
Thanks very much, Dr. Webb. It's a true delight to be with you. I've been assigned the topic of health reform, a topic that couldn't be more timely. The Congress of the United States passed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act back in the spring of 2009, and very rapidly after, President Barack Obama signed it into law. It officially took effect in 2010, but right now, 2014, is when the main elements of the law are actually finally coming into play. You may recall last fall we saw the initial rollout of the federal government's healthcare insurance exchanges. We're just 2 weeks away, a little less, March 31st, before every adult citizen of the country needs to either have health insurance or pay a hefty federal fine. In talking about health reform, I really want to think of it in two different ways. The first I'm going to talk about is seeking after miracles, which is a pretty apt description, as it turns out. It's top down. It's health reform from a government level. The second way, to my mind, is much more interesting. It's bottom-up. It's coming off the front lines of the healing professions and building up. I've titled that one, Better Has No Limit. The reason for that, it's the duty of every generation of the healing professions to pass along something a little better than we ourselves received, to make the world a better place, and I think you're going to see that come through very dramatically. I've labeled that, we count our successes in lives. Well, to return to the first type of health reform, we really need to understand two things. It has to do with forests and trees, where you can't see the forest for the trees, as I hope you'll see in a moment. Yeah, the second topic is called the great equation. We need to get that on the table, but before that, a more important one. The trees are supplied by something called the rule of rescue. In 1986, a fellow named Johnson defined the rule of rescue as the imperative people feel to rescue identifiable individuals facing suffering or death. Now, later commentators asked an important question. They said, do the things we do have to work? Do they have to be efficacious? The answer appears to be no. It's the effort that counts. It's do something, she's dying. A classic example. It's that new housing development down in Texas. The kids are out playing in the field behind the house. They come running in. You discover that your five-year-old has stepped into the uncapped head of an exploratory oil well. She's in an 18-inch diameter tube, 75 feet below ground, can't move, jammed into the tube in the complete dark, but you have a small voice calling up from the earth, "Mom, Dad, help me." Turns out that adult humans will spend every resource we possess. We'll risk and even lose any number of adult lives and will not count the cost to rescue that child. That's the rule of rescue right there. Interestingly, it doesn't just apply to humans. We react the same way to animals in certain circumstances. Whales trapped in the Arctic ice. A real story of a dog on an abandoned fishing boat out of Honolulu. The same response. In some ways, it's the best thing about us as human beings. This deep concern for others. But interestingly, it's an emotional response. It requires a name and a face. We don't react this way to statistics. A subconscious empathy triggers our reaction. Now, that applies in healthcare too. When it comes to rescue care, the United States dominates the world. For example, 2 years ago, we had the 20th anniversary of Princess Diana's death in an automobile accident in Paris. Every time that comes up, most of the argument is in Paris and London. It reignites an old debate. If Diana had had that accident in any major American city, including Provo, Utah, she would be alive today. As clinicians, we diagnose her injuries, dissect the treatment she received. It's not that France doesn't have a trauma care system. It's just not widely available to all citizens. They have the technology, just not widely deployed. These statistics that you're seeing on the slide come from something called OECD, Collaboration of All First World Nations, and it's accurate. It's statistically significant as well. Mortality following major trauma in the United States is literally half of what it is in European countries, in Canada, in Australia, because of that widely deployed rescue system. A second wonderful example, heart attacks. Our mortality rates are two-thirds of what they are in other first world nations. Just as an illustration, liver transplants per 100,000 population, we roughly double what happens in Europe. The examples of this are endless, or almost endless. Cancer care, kidney transplants. Well, it's associated with very sophisticated, high-technology medicine. Specialty care is another name for this idea of rescue. Now, some things you need to know about it. Care delivery in the United States is roughly twice as expensive as any other country spends. About half of that price difference is the fact that we engage so heavily in rescue. Other countries don't. They redeploy the resources to other destinations. The second half is something called unit pricing. We spend more per physician than Europe does, more per nurse, more for a dose of a specific drug, more for a lab test. We bear most of the burden of research in the world, in this country, by paying higher prices. Truth is very often rescue care feels like miracles, and they are miracles if you've ever experienced them. I have that privilege often. Back when I was practicing medicine, still see it today. You pull somebody back from the jaws of death, literally sometimes. Those are the trees. Those miracles, they stick in people's mind to the point where you can't see anything else. Oh, the key thing about rescue care, it does not significantly increase population-level life expectancy. By life expectancy, I mean how long and how well people live, in summary, across a population. The reason is it averages height information, number one. Number two, I might have to treat 5, 10, even more than that people to get the one miracle. The technologies we use are innately dangerous. Anything that's powerful enough to heal can also harm, and it's usually associated with small losses in life expectancy for the ones where we don't get the win, for the misses. But when you sum it up, not one person but 10, it attenuates the effect in the one, doesn't it? When you get those small losses, it attenuates it even further. But in summary, rescue care does not drive life expectancy in this country or others. In some sense, though, again, it's the best thing about us. being willing to step up when somebody is facing some of life's most difficult challenges. Well, that leads us to the second key principle we need on the table. Back in 1977, a really smart man named Aaron Wildavsky called it the Great Equation. It's the idea that health, how long and how well you live, depends on medical care. Medical care, of course, is meaningless without access to care, and access to care means health insurance. So let me just ask the question, is health insurance the most important thing in determining how long and how well you will live? Well, just a couple of examples. Back in 2002, the Winter Olympics were coming to Utah. The world was beating a path to our door, and the LDS, we really are kind of a peculiar people, and one of the most prominent things people see is our dietary habits around smoking and alcohol, the word of wisdom. My offices happen to be right across the street from the church offices in Salt Lake, and one day we got a request. Would we go out and do a literature review about the health impact of the word of wisdom, array the evidence for people who came with questions during the Olympics? And we did. We found about 60 major articles. Just to give you a very brief summary of the findings, they're much broader than this. This was comparing religiously active LDS men in Southern California literally to their neighbors, living in the same environment, the same communities, balanced on other factors. The only difference was activity in the LDS church. Oh, members of the LDS church lived on average 7 years longer. They had about 50% of the age-adjusted mortality rate of their non-LDS counterparts. Now, this isn't unique to the LDS church. Anybody who follows those health activities gets the same effect, sometimes even more profoundly. Just to illustrate, there's a large group of people in the United Kingdom, about 20,000 strong, a community that they've been tracking now for over 25 years. They went into the Norfolk Project. They identified those who use no tobacco, very, very limited alcohol use. That's the first half of the word of wisdom that we all tend to follow religiously. They also track, though, dietary habits and regular exercise. That's the second half of the word of wisdom that sometime in LDS communities we tend to ignore just a bit. In that study, those who did well on those four factors compared to those who did not on all four had one quarter the mortality rate and lived on average 14 years longer. There are different visions of the same thing. For example, we know that people in Europe live on average about 3 years longer than people in the United States. This is used as a criticism of the healthcare delivery system. A couple of years ago, a group called the National Research Council, they're also part of the National Academy of Sciences, did a formal evidence review. They were tracking down the reason for differences in life expectancy. They found three main things. Number one, much higher smoking rates in the United States. We're actually seeing the tail of that. These smoking rates were higher about 30 to 50 years ago, but the health consequences of those behaviors are now just playing through our population. Frankly, Americans tend to be more obese, exhibit a more sedentary lifestyle, which we understand shortens life as well. Less effective preventive measures, usually at a primary care level. Interestingly, they concluded that the healthcare delivery system in the United States probably was a bit better than in Europe. Another way of looking at it, a natural experiment, prospectively testing the impact of healthcare delivery. This happened in the state of Oregon. They had about 90,000 adults who were technically under the federal poverty level, but the state didn't have sufficient budget to place them on the health care insurance program, Medicaid, for the poor. They had a budget windfall. It wasn't sufficient to fund all 90,000, though. About 30,000 people could come into health insurance. They did it randomly. They used a lottery to select them, and so doing created what we call a randomized controlled trial, the ideal, the pinnacle study design. Well, after 25 months under that plan, they checked to see what impact it had had. Now, it did have a fairly significant impact on money. On average, those new Medicaid recipients had $215 less out-of-pocket expenses each year. Probably closer to $8,000 in state expenditures on their health care. Those who face catastrophic expenditures without insurance, that means less than 30% of your income relative to health care needs, That's a more dramatic fall from 5.5% to 1%. However, there was no change in health status across a series of important conditions within the context of this controlled trial. Does that surprise you, that there was no change given what we've just talked about? Yeah. Probably the best summary study on this topic comes from a man named Mike McGinnis. He's a surgeon who's now at the Institute of Medicine in Washington. He summarized the literature in terms of what determines total health, how long and how well you'll live, life expectancy. Now, with his permission, I've rounded these off to make them memorable. 40%, 30%, 20%, 10%. In fact, behaviors were 42% of your life expectancy in that study. The major sources of loss of life to behaviors, number one is tobacco, number two is alcohol and other recreational drugs. Number three, Joe Andrade, former chief of bioengineering at the University of Utah, calls it MDD, movement deficit disorder. I suffer from it personally. I would much rather admit to that medicalized condition that I'm just a bit overweight and don't get enough exercise. It's obesity, of course, which may be supplanting alcohol at number two today. Number four, sexually transmitted disease, including AIDS. Number five, I've listed it as unwed teenage pregnancy. Teenagers are perfectly capable of bearing healthy children. The problem is the lack of a social support network for this new small family, mostly realized in damage to the health of the newborn. Finally, number six, suicide, violence, and accidents, primarily among young men. This report from the American Medical Association estimated that more than half of all health care expenses in the United States of America today track straight back to bad behaviors in those six areas. Well, if that's 42% of your total health, about 30% comes from your genes. The joke is how wise you were in selecting your parents. We've started to make some major scientific inroads into this category. Still too early, though, to have widely available interventions that can change a patient's future relative to genetic predispositions. 23% turned out to be something called public health. It mostly has to do with the control of epidemic infectious disease through immunization and sanitation. So those cholera epidemics that would kill thousands, smallpox that probably killed half of the people in North and South America, allowing Europeans to settle. When that was introduced among Native American tribes, a population with no natural immunity introduced from Europe. Pertussis, diphtheria in children. Beyond control of epidemic infectious disease, it's clean air, safe water, good food. If I turn instead, though, to this grand enterprise, the healthcare delivery system, hospitals and clinics, doctors and nurses that today consume $2.8 trillion per year, 18% of our national wealth, of the gross domestic product, at best it accounts for about 10% of how long and how well you'll live. This is where the miracles happen, though. Down there in that small margin. Well, actually, in saying 10%, I'm being generous. If I put on my green visor and sharpen my pencil and get scientifically rigorous, it's probably closer to 5. Well, 5 to 10%, that's still 3.5 to 7 years in life expectancy across the entire population of the United States on average. And frankly, at my age, that doesn't look too bad. Let's not get too cavalier here about what this is producing. Yeah, Baldovsky noted even way back in 1977 this idea of the great equation that health equals medical care, and medical care means access to care equals insurance. The great equation is fundamentally wrong. The evidence doesn't support the conclusions associated with that viewpoint. You know, I spent most of the spring of 2009 traveling back and forth to Washington, D.C. It was a season of reform. I was asked to testify twice to the Senate Finance Committee. That's the main source of health policy in Washington, Senate Finance. Once to Ted Kennedy's Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. That's number two. Once to the money guys on the House side, House Ways and Means. More than that, I spent many, many hours working with the senior staff of those committees. That's where the real work of legislation takes place, in those committees. That's where the issues are debated. The compromises are forged. Well, the biggest part, that's where the legislation gets drafted. we had two issues on the table. The first was 46 million Americans without health insurance, 46 million Americans under 65 years of age. It just seems wrong that the richest economy on the planet should have that hold true, 17% of our population without access to that essential resource, you see. The second, in some ways, was even more important. It had to do with the rate of cost increases for healthcare delivery. In 1960, healthcare delivery consumed 6% of our total national wealth, the gross domestic product. 54 years later, 2014, as I mentioned earlier, almost 18%, $2.8 trillion per year, and it continues to grow rapidly. I tried to make the argument that we should focus on number two first, the cost of healthcare, that if we failed to do so, expanding insurance would be pouring gasoline on an already raging fire, and as we'll see in a moment, holding the real potential to destroy the United States government financially. The truth is that our political colleagues had no appetite for discipline, for restraint, even for eating their vegetables. They much preferred their dessert. They wanted to expand an important entitlement. It's fair to say that they were seeing the trees and not necessarily seeing the forest. Interesting statistic. It turns out that healthy behaviors depend primarily on your education level. You can get more health benefit at a population level from investing in general education. I mean, more high school graduates, more college graduates will have a bigger impact on the health of a population than investing the same dollars in health care delivery. I actually have four things that tie together. Healthy behaviors depend upon education level. Education level, of course, drives income level. Two-way street, tightly associated with income levels, and of course, that's associated with lack of insurance. You get those four tied together, almost impossible to pick apart. But I think you get an idea what I meant when I said that we're seeking after miracles. It's like we sell lottery tickets while using other people's money, very expensive lottery tickets, and everyone wants a shot at the miracle. You see? The thing you need to know is it's not what will determine, on average, for most people, your health across your life. Your own behaviors are dramatically more important. Public health has a much bigger impact. Yes, the Affordable Care Act, it really wasn't health reform. It was insurance reform. It will reduce the number of uninsured in this country from about 46 million to something in the range of 20 to 30 million when it comes fully up on plane, is fully deployed. It will also significantly increase government spending on health care. The problem is it's not health reform. And that increase in health care costs, if you thought the debate over health care was settled, was going to go away, was going to attenuate a bit, sorry. If anything, it's going to become dramatically more intense than it's been in the past. We'll go into round two about real health reform. Can I talk to you about that for a bit? Real health reform. I believe that the reason the Congress of the United States didn't really address health reform is because they can't. It doesn't lend itself well to top-down planning. It's something that comes much more heavily with bottom-up planning. The year was 1986. I just left the Harvard School of Public Health and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, had a professorship there. Came back to the mountains and, well, a new idea. It was a bunch of trained clinical researchers. We knew how to measure. What would happen if you used the rigorous tools of clinical research to measure routine care delivery performance? Now, the truth is if you did a Medline search looking for major articles and peer-reviewed journals published over the last 50 years around this topic, you'll roll out more than 40,000 articles, amazingly consistent in tone, tenor, and findings. I'd like to break it down, though, into five subcategories. I need you to think about this in a particular way, though. I want you to think of it as opportunity. It's easy to make the case that Americans today have better health care and better health than any previous generation of people living on this planet. It's easy to make the case, especially if you look along the line of rescue care, that it's the best you can find anywhere in the world. It's the duty, though, of every generation of the healing professions to take that next step ahead, you see. This is really a list of areas where we fall short of our theoretic potential. The first step in improvement is nearly always to identify opportunities, and that's how you need to think about this. We do routinely achieve miracles, but they could be much better miracles. Five major areas. It starts, well, with variation, geographic variation. Back in 1973, a man named Jack Weinberg, a professor at Dartmouth University, published a seminal paper in the journal Science. He had looked at different communities, often neighboring communities in the United States, and looked at the rates at which people were hospitalized for common conditions. Now, he carefully balanced the population factors, age, gender, ethnicity, and the big one, burden of comorbid disease. What's your status, health status going in? But still showed 20, 30, 40-fold variation. Sometimes literally 30 miles apart. It was dramatic. It turns out that where you lived was more important than whether you had insurance in determining the care that you would actually receive. Stunning. It called into question the whole idea of medical practice. We call it the craft of medicine. It's how I was trained, how Dr. Samuelson was trained as well. It's the idea that owing a foundational ethical responsibility to the patient, that I agree that I'll put a patient's health care needs before any other end or goal. Then drawing on this massive knowledge base gained from formal training and from practice experience, I can start largely with raw materials, and for each patient who seeks my help, I can craft, and craft is exactly the right word, a unique diagnostic and therapeutic experience for that individual. And the promise we make as a profession is that that approach guarantees the best possible medical outcome. Well, when you looked at the geographic variation, it became apparent that it was pretty much impossible that all Americans, even with full access to care, could possibly be getting best care. It questioned our whole foundational ethic, you see. Others came behind, said perhaps we can explain geographic variation by inappropriate care. They developed rigorous instruments for assessing appropriateness. Now, appropriateness is purely a medical definition. Care is inappropriate if the risk inherent in the treatment outweighs any potential benefit. This among professions that hold as our first maxim, first do no harm. We had two major findings out of that body of research. The first, inappropriate care does not explain geographic variation. Low utilization communities had about the same amount of care judged clinically inappropriate on careful review by one's peers as high utilization communities. Secondary finding that was much more troubling. For some major treatments routinely performed in U.S. hospitals, as much as 32% of all care delivered, judged to be clinically inappropriate. Where the risk outweighed any potential benefit, it should never have been undertaken, but was, usually under the rubric of the rule of rescue. November 30th, 1999, the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Quality of Health Care in America publishes a report called To Err Is Human. You may have heard of it. That's where we estimated somewhere between 44,000 and 98,000 preventable deaths each year in hospitals, where the cause of death was not the patient's underlying disease, but the treatments they received for those diseases. Well, treatments that two independent physician reviewers separately agreed were completely avoidable. Unnecessary deaths. Truth in Advertising, my name's on the report. I was a member of that committee. We'd done an evidence review, found about 60 major articles. Believe it or not, we were trying to be conservative. By the way, the 44,000 number comes from Utah, where we'd done a particular study that they used in that report. Since then, we've had subsequent research that shows we were conservative. Just 3 or 4 months ago, a man named John James, no relation, published an updated estimate of 200,000 preventable deaths per year. Now, don't be too judgmental about that. You have to remember that on net, healthcare delivery adds 3.5 to 7 years of life to every person in the United States, and that's net of these injuries. The upside is hugely greater than the downside, and any clinician understands that you're very often walking a thin line between help and harm. A medication that's absolutely life-saving in a therapeutic dose, slight overdose can be as deadly as you can imagine, you see. And it's almost impossible to stop stepping over the line. It means that you didn't read the second half of the report. We understood how difficult it was to deliver that level of care. We laid out a system, though, by which you could dramatically reduce injury rates by as much as 60 or 70% and still get all the benefits. That was the point, that we could be so much better. Number four on the list, we have some things that we know for a fact work. Hard evidence of benefit, usually with strong randomized controlled trial evidence, they tend to be non-controversial within the medical profession. Well, Beth McGlynn at Rand measured how well we executed. Turns out we got it right 54.9% of the time for adults, 46% of the time for children. Now, if I can routinely achieve miracles doing it correctly, 50% of the time roughly, what kind of miracles could I achieve if I could do it correctly, something much closer to 100% of the time? We call these injuries of omission. The last on the list in some ways is the most important, though. A few years ago, a colleague and I, Dr. Lucy Savitz, got a little grant from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. We tried to take Ed Deming's methods, the father of quality improvement theory, and map them over into healthcare. You see, he defined a very broad definition of waste in care delivery. When we did that, we ended up with a six-part model. We could find national estimates for two of the six. The other four were non-trivial. But on the basis of those two alone, we estimated that at least 50% of all resources consumed in healthcare delivery today are technically waste, non-value-adding from a patient's perspective. Oh, wait a minute. That's 50% of a $2.8 trillion per year budget. When President Obama says the key to the U.S. economy is healthcare, he is exactly technically correct. Well, on that foundation, we were one of the major contributors to the variation research and started to study and learn from variation in care delivery. Yeah, why is that important? It's called the fiscal gap. The deficit is part of that, currently at $17.4 trillion, but far more important is the rate at which it will grow in the future. Social Security, for example, for people alive in 2009, $7.7 trillion short of meeting its obligations. That's why you young people shouldn't count on it too much, at least in its present form. That's despite consuming 13% of all wages and salaries, roughly, 6.5% on your pay stub, 6.5% in matching funds from your employer. Oh, pales in comparison to Medicare, $38.7 trillion shortfall. That totals to about $63 trillion. Now, this comes from a fellow named Walker at the Government Accounting Agency back in 2009. A far better analyst, the most respected man in Washington, I think, on this topic, is a fellow named Foster, also at Medicare, but he runs the Office of the Actuary. He says the real number for people alive in 2009 is about twice that, $120 trillion. He said if we do it into the far future as a net present value, $211 trillion. Oh, wait a minute. $211 trillion, that's a really big number. I wonder what that means. The best way I know to put it into perspective for you, the present value of the United States of America, all public and private, physical and intellectual property, your homes, your cars, the apartments in which you live, the Marriott Center, this whole university, my suit, everything, about $75 trillion. Technically, the government of the United States is bankrupt. I mean, not just morally and politically, but financially, is the joke. Did you notice that two-thirds of the shortfall is health care? In that context, go back with me to 1991, LDS Hospital in Salt Lake City. Dr. Alan Morris is a major pulmonary researcher. We were studying a disease called acute respiratory distress syndrome. Now, I don't need to go into the details of the disease except to say that it's a really, really nasty killer. Normally, we manage this disease in an ICU with a mechanical ventilator, put you on a ventilator, use high-end expiratory pressures and oxygen concentrations to try to get oxygen into your blood through a lung that's fluid-filled. You leak tissue fluid into the air spaces of the lung. No more gas exchange. Well, a group in Italy had come up with some beautiful rescue care. It was an artificial lung called ECOR, where you circulated the patient's blood out of their body to remove carbon dioxide and add oxygen. As we put together the trial, an issue came up. Up to this point in time, everyone just assumed that expert intensivists managed ventilators about the same. Some of the finest science we have in all of medicine, strong physiologic models, but for the first time in light of the variation literature, we thought to look. What we found was massive variation. Now, this is absolutely deadly to a trial. That's why we use protocols in the arms of trials. If you don't deliver the care in a consistent fashion in the arms of trials, you can't tell if the treatments you use are causally linked to patient outcomes, which is what you're seeking, or if it's secondary to the bias associated with inconsistent treatment. We therefore set out to develop a protocol for ventilator management. It's rife with difficulty. I won't go into the details. But Alan chose to use it in a really clever way, based around a body of quality theory called Lean, something called mass customization. Here's the functional version that we routinely deploy within Intermountain Healthcare today. You identify a high-priority clinical process. The biggest single one we do is pregnancy, labor, and delivery. We deliver about 34,000 babies a year. Second biggest is management of ischemic heart disease, heart attacks, and related diseases. That's the second biggest in Utah. Well, somewhere on that list is acute respiratory distress syndrome as well. You build an evidence-based best practice protocol, rife with difficulties, build it anyway. I guarantee it will be imperfect. Next thing, you blend it into clinical workflow so it doesn't rely on human memory. Today's environment is too complex, even for truly masterful experts, to keep track of all the detail. When you rely on human memory, pieces fall off routinely. Well, don't rely on memory. We have about 20 tools, standing order sets, patient flow sheets, patient worksheets, a whole series of tools, so that if you just let it happen, doctor, what you get is evidence-based best practice, you see. Number four, you also embed a data system. It's going to track two things: protocol variations, more on that in a minute, and also what happens to your patient, short and long-term patient outcomes. Step five is my favorite. The way I say it to physicians and nurses in Intermountain goes something like this. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not just that we allow or even that we encourage. We demand that you modify our shared baseline protocol based on individual patient need. I have hard evidence that you cannot write a protocol that perfectly fits any patient. The humans who come to us for care are just too variable from one another, you see. But you see, we don't stop there. We take the variation data when someone needs to vary and feed it back so that we can learn about best care. In some sense, these are little homing missiles. Well, can I show you what happened with ARDS? In the most seriously ill subcategory of patients, survival increased from 9.5% to 44%. First time since this syndrome was defined in the 1960s that anyone had shown an improvement in clinical outcome. Across the entire disease, survival increased from about 50% to 70%. At the same time, costs dropped. Now, I haven't gone through the theory. This comes from Deming. Nearly always, higher quality means lower cost. It eliminates waste. At $1.4 trillion of waste, this is how you get after it. Interestingly, it also improves clinician productivity. Can I show you another quick example just to make a couple of points as we wrap up? The number one cause of death in American hospitals today is sepsis, a body-wide infection. More than half of those cases enter the hospital through the emergency department. Well, Dr. Todd Allen, one of our emergency room physicians, Dr. Terry Klemmer, one of the fathers of intensive medicine in the country, runs ICUs. They came together to build a shared baseline protocol for this condition, fairly complex, with 13 major steps. This shows change in compliance as they tuned it across 3 years by feeding the data back, letting people vary, then feeding it back. They went from 30% compliance to 90% compliance. Now, nationwide, mortality for this condition ranges from about 20% to about 50%. As many as half of these people die. When we started, we were among the best in the nation, 20% mortality. In association with that protocol, once again, mortality dramatically dropped. It's now been 3 years since we've gone over 9% at any of our four biggest tertiary hospitals in the Intermountain system. A dramatic improvement in care, a new national standard. Oh, it's another 125 lives per year, roughly. You see, the trick is, I have more than 100 of these. I can document more than 1,000 lives per year of people who a few years ago would have died, who don't today. And as some of you probably understand, mortality is the tip of the iceberg. Far more dramatic effects in terms of function restored, suffering averted. Lesson number one from this work: In this profession, we count our successes in lives, literally. We could be much better for the patients we serve in that new evolving healthcare system. Number two, our costs fell as usual. It saved the people of the state of Utah about $1.3 million per year. In terms of actual operating capital for Intermountain, about $700,000. The second big message, better care is usually cheaper care. In fact, I can document about $350 million per year, taking out of the cost of operations of Intermountain, money that indirectly comes back to you, members of this community. Well, that's where I want to leave you. I wanted you to see real health care reform. It's happening. It's happening broadly. We have not yet begun to understand how good we can be for our patients and our greatest needs, but that's the goal. We have a theme at my Institute for Healthcare Delivery Research. It's an old Yiddish proverb, better has no limit. It's the duty of every generation to make life better. With that, let me say thanks for your time and attention and return the time to Dr. Webb.